Imagine sitting in the third row of a dim, crowded theater. You know, you're skeptical. You're an adult with a mortgage, a car payment, and a rational understanding of physics.
Right, you're not easily fooled.
Exactly. But then the performer on stage points directly at you, asks you to think of the name of your childhood best friend, and then, without you ever opening your mouth, he writes the name Jonathan on a chalkboard.
Oh, wow.
And in that split second, you feel it, that tiny electric thrill of impossibility. Your logical brain, the part of you that stops at red lights and balances checkbooks, knows unequivocally that what just happened is a trick.
It has to be, right?
It has to be. But your senses, your heart rate, your absolute bewilderment, your senses are completely hopelessly compromised.
Yeah, you just watch the impossible happen right in front of your eyes. And for a fleeting moment, you actually believe it.
I mean, I definitely would.
Well, it is the ultimate experience of cognitive dissonance. We are evolutionarily wired to believe what our eyes tell us.
Because seeing is believing.
Exactly. For millions of years, if you saw a tiger in the brush, there was a
Yeah.
tiger in the brush. So when we encounter something that violently fractures the laws of physics or, the known boundaries of human capability, our brain essentially short circuits.
It just kind of gives up.
Yeah, we all walk around believing our perception is this impenetrable, objective fortress of reality. We think we see the world exactly as it is, but the reality is that fortress have a back door.
A backdoor that certain people know how to use.
Right. And masters of their craft, they know exactly how to pick the lock.
And I want to know exactly how they do it. I really want to see the lock picks.
We are definitely going to get into that today.
So we are tearing into some genuinely brilliant source material for this deep dive, specifically excerpts from Bob Cassidy's book, The Art of Mentalism 3. And Bob Cassidy is, I mean, he's a titan in the world of mentalism.
Absolutely, a legend.
But the mission here isn't just to hand out spoilers for your uncle's favorite card trick. Knowing a secret is usually pretty anticlimactic, honestly. The goal here is so much bigger. We are going to deconstruct the actual foundational architecture of human deception.
And to do that, Cassidy lays out a framework that is essentially built on two interlocking pillars. First, you have the methods.
Right, the actual mechanics.
Exactly. These are the secret physical mechanics, the hidden gears turning in the dark, the sleight of hand, the gimmicks. Second, and arguably far more important, you have the language.
And we're not just talking about English or French here.
No. By language, Cassidy means the spoken words, the carefully choreographed body language, the psychological framing. It's the storytelling that wraps around the physical method.
So it's everything the audience is experiencing on a conscious level.
Precisely. The central thesis we are pulling from his work is that the difference between a cheap, embarrassing party trick and a masterful, reality-bending illusion lies entirely in how flawlessly a performer synchronizes those physical methods with their language.
And that intersection is what completely fascinates me, because this goes way beyond a stage in Las Vegas, you
Oh, it
know?
really does.
This is a masterclass in human psychology and observation. It's about how easily our perception of reality can be gently guided or, you know, violently hijacked by a casually placed word or a gesture that looks completely natural.
Right, because if you can understand the mechanics of how a mentalist uses language and physical method to deceive you for entertainment, you start to see those exact same tools being deployed in the real world.
Every single day, in ads, in meetings.
Everywhere. The stage is essentially a controlled laboratory for human manipulation.
That's a great way to put it.
The principles that convince an audience you can read minds are the exact same principles that make a high-stakes sales pitch work. Or, that swing a political debate, or give someone the upper hand in a hostage negotiation.
So understanding this text is really about recognizing the inherent vulnerabilities in our own cognition.
Exactly, it's a mirror.
Well, before we start digging into the actual mechanics of how these illusions are pulled off, we have to look at the performer's mindset.
The ethics of it all.
Yeah. Cassidy spends a lot of time establishing the ethical framework of deception. He focuses on the language mentalists use to justify what is fundamentally just lying to people's faces.
Deception is a really thorny subject, but Cassidy grounds the entire discussion with a very specific operational definition.
Which is?
He defines mentalism as the art of presenting seemingly paranormal effects in an entertaining manner. The essence of the art form lies entirely in the performer's ability to successfully suspend the disbelief of the audience.
So entertaining manner and suspend disbelief are the key phrases there.
Right. He draws a remarkably sharp line in the sand between an entertainer and a charlatan. The text argues that an entertainer plays to an audience while a charlatan plays with them.
Oh, I like that distinction. It's the difference between mutual participation and sheer exploitation.
Exactly. A mentalist on a stage wants you to be amazed. They want you to experience that thrill of the unknown.
They are playing a theatrical role, and you, the audience, are complicit in that game.
Right. Whereas the charlatan, the fraudulent medium, the fake psychic, uses the exact same physical methods, the exact same linguistic misdirection, but their goal is vastly different.
They want your money. They want your emotional dependence.
Yes. It's a complete violation of trust.
It makes me think of a haunted house dynamic.
Yeah.
When you pay $30 to walk through a haunted house in October, you want to be terrified, right? You are actively paying for the illusion of danger inside a perfectly safe environment.
Yeah, you know what you're signing up for.
Right. You logically know that the guy jumping out of the closet with a chainsaw is a sophomore theater major named Greg, and, you know, the chainsaw doesn't have a chain on it.
But you scream anyway.
Exactly. You let your heart rate spike because you have willingly suspended your disbelief. But a fake psychic... that's entirely different.
It really is.
That's like a doctor handing you a fake terminal diagnosis just to sell you a miracle cure. The fake psychic finds grieving people, uses cold reading techniques to pump them for private information, and then drains their savings accounts by pretending their dead husband is speaking through them.
It's awful.
The haunted house relies on a mutual agreement, but the fake medium relies on malicious misrepresentation.
And what becomes really interesting in Cassidy's analysis is how the language a performer uses directly dictates their ethical standing.
How so?
Well, if your goal is purely theatrical entertainment, you don't actually need to make grand, sweeping claims about having supernatural powers or speaking to the dead. The public is remarkably savvy.
Yeah, they bought a ticket to a show. They know it's a show.
Right. However, Cassidy points out a pervasive trend in modern mentalism where performers try to have it both ways. And they do it through pseudoscientific framing.
Oh, the pseudoscience pivot. I see this everywhere now.
It's so common.
Cassidy talks about how modern performers have largely abandoned the old school aesthetic. No more crystal balls, no more flowing turbans, no more claiming to have been struck by lightning and gifted with psychic sight.
Yeah, those days are mostly gone.
Instead, they hit the audience with this barrage of clinical, psychological language. They explicitly claim, I am not psychic, there is no such thing.
But then they follow it up with something equally unbelievable.
Exactly. They say, what I am doing is reading your micro expressions. I am utilizing advanced kinesics, suggestibility, and hypersensory observation. They wrap their tricks in the language of a university psychology department.
And Cassidy points out the deep irony here. By claiming to use highly enhanced but ultimately normal human skills to appear more credible, these performers are fundamentally still misrepresenting what they are doing.
They're still lying.
Yes. If a performer's doing a billet switch, a purely physical sleight of hand, to swap a folded piece of paper, but they tell the audience they knew the word, because they read a micro-muscle twitch in the spectator's cheek, they are lying.
Claiming pseudoscience instead of magic doesn't magically make it ethical.
Not at all. It just changes the flavor of the deception to something modern audiences are more likely to swallow without questioning.
I actually wonder if that's more damaging in the long run.
What do you mean?
Well, if I tell you I'm magic, you know I'm an entertainer. But if I tell you I can read your mind by looking at your body language, I might convince you that this is a real, learnable science, which fuels a whole different kind of misinformation.
Oh, it absolutely fuels misinformation. We see it constantly today with internet body language experts who analyze a 10-second clip of a celebrity.
Oh my gosh, yes.
And they claim they can definitively prove the person is lying based on, like, how they cross their arms. It's the exact same pseudoscientific framing Cassidy is criticizing.
So Cassidy actually uses a massive historical figure to show how a true master navigates this, Joseph Dunninger.
Yes, Dunninger was an absolute giant in the early to mid-20th century.
He had massive radio broadcasts, television shows. He was a household name. And he lived during an era where fraudulent spirit mediums were a genuine societal plague, scamming people out of fortunes.
Right, the spiritualism boom.
So Dunninger needed a way to categorically separate himself from the frauds. He had to prove he wasn't one of them.
And his strategy was a brilliant use of nonverbal contextual language. To prove he wasn't claiming supernatural spiritual powers, Dunninger would deliberately incorporate classic, recognizable magic tricks right into the middle of his mentalism act.
He would just randomly do a magic trick.
Yeah. He would perform something like the egg bag trick, where an egg vanishes and reappears in a small cloth bag, or the linking rings.
Wait, really? He's supposed to be reading minds on national radio, and he stops to do the linking rings. That is such a bizarre juxtaposition.
It seems completely jarring until you understand the framing. By placing a standard, obvious magic trick next to his mind-reading effects, Dunninger was making a silent but incredibly loud statement.
He was telling them what he was.
Yes. He was saying, look, I am a magician. I use methods. I use scientific principles and stagecraft. A fraudulent psychic whose entire livelihood depends on people believing they are a genuine vessel for spirits would never in a million years perform the egg bag.
It's an immediate admission of theatrical deception.
Exactly. Dunninger used the props of magic to frame his mentalism as an art form rather than a miracle.
Cassidy does drop a hilarious warning in the book about this, though. He notes that ordinary mortal mentalists should probably not try throwing the hippity-hop rabbits into their sophisticated mind-reading act.
Yeah, that would probably ruin the mood.
Definitely. There is a very real limit to how goofy and prop-heavy you can get before you shatter the mysterious atmosphere entirely. Dunninger had the sheer charisma to pull it off, but most people don't.
No, they definitely don't.
But the core lesson holds up, right? The contextual language you build around your performance dictates how the audience categorizes you.
Absolutely. So we have the ethical foundation in the framing, but language alone can't make a physical object disappear or teleport.
At some point, the performer's hands have to do the dirty work.
Right, and they have to do it while hundreds of eyes are burning a hole into them. This brings us to Cassidy's breakdown of physical methods and why simply knowing the secret of a trick is vastly different from understanding how the trick actually functions in the real world.
This is honestly my favorite part of the source material. Cassidy uses this ancient classic piece of East Indian street magic to prove his point.
The rayon stick.
Yes. It's an effect performed by street magicians known as Jadu Wallahs. Let's paint the picture of what this actually looks like for you.
Okay, let's set the scene.
Imagine a bustling, dusty street in India. The performer is surrounded completely by a tight circle of spectators. There are no trapdoors, no mirrors, no special lighting.
Just a guy in the street.
Just a guy. He brings out a long, thin, solid wooden cane. He hands it out. People tap it, bend it. It's just a regular stick. He then asks to borrow a wedding ring from someone in the crowd.
Let's track the participants to make this clear. We'll call the person who loans the ring Spectator A.
Okay, Spectator A. The magician takes Spectator A's borrowed wedding ring, holding it right at his fingertips. He pulls out a handkerchief, carefully wraps the ring inside the fabric, and hands that bundled up handkerchief right back to Spectator A.
So Spectator A is holding it.
Right. Hold this, the magician says, and feel your ring inside. Spectator A pinches the cloth, feels the hard metal circle of their ring right there through the fabric, and holds on tight.
Next, the magician brings in two more people from the crowd, Spectator B and Spectator C. He instructs them to hold the ends of the solid wooden cane.
So they're locking it in place.
Exactly. Spectator B grips the left end tightly in his fist. Spectator C grips the right end. The cane is now completely immobilized.
Okay, the stage is set. The magician announces that he is going to cause the borrowed wedding ring to pass solid through solid directly onto the center of the wooden stick without B or C ever letting go of the ends.
Which sounds impossible.
Totally. He tells the crowd he needs a moment of darkness for the magic to happen, so he has Spectator A hold the handkerchief, which still contains the ring, draped directly over the center of the wooden stick.
And then?
The magician steps back and yells, "Let go!" Spectator A drops the handkerchief. The magician whips the cloth away into the air. And right there, spinning merrily in the dead center of the wooden cane, is the borrowed wedding ring.
That's incredible.
B and C are still clutching the ends. The stick is solid. The ring is solid. It is a completely impossible physical penetration.
Cassidy calls it a small masterpiece of magic. And to explain the mechanics of it, he references an old exposure of the trick written by a Major L.H. Branson.
Right, he was a British officer in the Indian Army.
Yeah, he published a book trying to reveal how these street performers operated.
Yeah.
Branson's explanation is very straightforward. He claims the stick is entirely ordinary.
So no trick stick.
No trick stick. The secret lies in the handkerchief. Sewn into the hem of one corner of the handkerchief is a duplicate cheap metal ring.
Okay, a duplicate.
Right. When the magician pretends to wrap the borrowed wedding ring in the center of the cloth, he actually palms the real ring in his hand, secretly hiding it. He then folds the corner of the handkerchief over and lets Spectator A hold the sewn-in duplicate ring through the fabric.
So Spectator A is pinching a ring, absolutely certain it's theirs, but it's just a dummy ring trapped in the hem.
Correct. Now, according to Major Branson's book, here is how the rest of the trick happens. The magician taps the handkerchief with the stick.
Okay.
During this tapping motion, he takes the opportunity to secretly slide the borrowed ring over the middle of it. He covers it with his hand, has B and C grab the ends, and then places the handkerchief over the center.
Wait.
And when the handkerchief is whipped away, the sewn-in dummy ring flies away with the cloth, brushing against the real ring on the stick to make it spin, creating the final illusion.
Okay, I have to stop right here because when I read Branson's explanation, my brain instantly rejected it.
Yeah, it doesn't really hold up.
Let's actually visualize doing this. I am secretly hiding a metal wedding ring in my curled right hand. My hand has to look natural, not like a tense claw.
Huh.
I'm holding a long wooden stick.
Right.
Branson literally just says the magician secretly slides the ring onto the middle of the stick. Have you ever tried to slide a tight metal ring onto a wooden rod one-handed in broad daylight while 30 people are staring directly at your hand?
It is an absolute ergonomic nightmare.
It's physically absurd. If the ring is a little bit too small, it scrapes against the wood. If it hits the end of the stick, it makes a loud metallic click.
And everyone hears it.
Exactly. Or what if your sweaty fingers slip? You drop a stranger's gold wedding ring into the dirt and you are standing there looking like an idiot. You cannot just casually slide it on without your arm contorting or your hand making a highly suspicious movement.
You'd look so guilty.
Branson's explanation completely falls apart the second you try to perform it in a three-dimensional space.
And this is precisely Cassidy's critique of exposure manuals. Branson accurately identified the props, the duplicate ring in the hem, the palming of the real ring. He explained the what.
But he entirely missed the how.
Yes. He missed the invisible language of movement required to actually make the deception functional. A trained observer wouldn't just be looking for a trick handkerchief. They would be looking at the tension in the performer's hands, the angles of the wrists, the timing of the eye contact.
So how does Cassidy actually do it? Because his breakdown of the true method is so smooth it almost makes me mad.
It's a masterclass in biomechanical choreography. Let's break down Cassidy's handling.
Okay, walk me through it.
He has the borrowed ring, palmed, hidden secretly at the base of his right fingers. He is holding the wooden stick. He turns to spectators B and C, who are standing on either side of him, to instruct them on how they need to grip the ends of the stick.
Right.
And as he does this, he says two specific words, like this.
Like this. That's it.
Those two words are the linguistic engine that powers the entire illusion. As he says, like this, he turns both of his hands upward and inward to physically demonstrate the overhand grip they should use.
Oh, I see.
In that totally natural, fluid, demonstrative motion of rotating his right hand inward, the palmed ring is automatically and silently threaded onto the very end of the stick, hidden completely by his gripping fingers.
That is just brilliant. The audience assumes the magic move happens later when the handkerchief is draped over the stick.
But the real work is done completely in the open, disguised as an instruction.
The physical language of demonstrating a grip provides an absolutely bulletproof cover for loading the ring.
But he still has a problem. The ring is on the end of the stick, under his hand. To finish the trick, it needs to be in the dead center of the stick.
Right. B and C are holding the ends.
Exactly. If he just slides his hand down the wood, it looks weird. So he needs a psychological justification for the movement.
And he creates one out of thin air. Cassidy takes the handkerchief, which contains the fake ring, and he tells the audience he wants to prove the ring is solidly inside.
Right.
He taps the wooden stick against the bundled fabric.
But he goes further. He says, listen, you can hear it's there, but I can't push this solid stick through the fabric. To illustrate this, he physically pushes the end of the stick against the cloth.
And as he executes this physical demonstration, pushing the stick against the resistance of the fabric, his right hand naturally slides down the shaft of the stick to brace it.
It makes perfect sense.
He literally just slides his hand to the middle of the cane, carrying the hidden ring right along with it. It looks perfectly natural. It looks mechanically necessary to brace the stick.
The takeaway here is profound when we look at the psychology of deception. The method is never just put the ring on the stick. The method is the perfectly choreographed dance of physical action and spoken misdirection.
The method and the language are one thing.
Yes. Every single physical movement has a stated, logical, explicit purpose. I am turning my hands to show you how to hold it. I am sliding my hand down the stick to brace it against the fabric.
It's all justified.
Exactly. When a physical movement has a logical justification provided by the spoken language, the audience's brain simply stops looking for a deceptive motive. The action becomes functionally invisible.
The words create a cognitive shadow, and the sleight of hand happens safely inside that shadow. If your brain accepts the reason for the movement, it stops analyzing the movement itself.
A beautiful way to put it.
But what happens when the tools of the trade actually fight against that natural movement? Cassidy points out that sometimes mentalists sabotage themselves because the tools they use are designed in a way that forces them to move unnaturally.
This is one of the most insightful critiques in the text. Cassidy argues that the terminology we use, the literal names we give our tools, can completely limit our ability to use them effectively.
The language is actually a trap.
Yes. The language of magic props creates unnatural biomechanical language. And the prime example he dissects is perhaps the oldest, most infamous tool in the history of magic. The thumb tip.
The legendary thumb tip.
You've heard of it.
Oh, even if you have never touched a magic trick in your life, you have probably heard of this. It's exactly what it sounds like. It's a hollow plastic or rubber shell painted to look like the tip of a human thumb.
Used for all sorts of things.
Magicians use them to make small silk handkerchiefs disappear. You push the silk into your fist, but you're actually stuffing it into the plastic thumb tip. Then you stick your right thumb into the tip, pull it out, open your hands, and the silk is gone. Hidden on your thumb.
But mentalists use the thumb tip for a different purpose. They use it to secretly switch out folded pieces of paper, which the industry calls billets.
Okay, billets.
Right, a billet is just a small slip of paper used to write down a word, a number, or a drawing that the mentalist will later reveal. Cassidy breaks down a highly revered classic technique called the Al Baker switch.
That's from a famous book, right?
Yes. It's published in Theodore Annemann's Practical Mental Effects, which is basically the Bible of mentalism. The goal of the Al Baker switch is to take a folded piece of paper from a spectator and seamlessly swap it for a different dummy piece of paper, all while the audience is watching your hands.
So how does the book say to do it?
To do this, the mentalist has the dummy paper folded up and hidden inside the plastic thumb tip, which they're wearing on their right thumb. Let's visualize the mechanics as dictated by the classic text.
Okay, visualizing.
The spectator hands their folded billet to the mentalist. The mentalist holds the spectator's billet in the open palm of their left hand. Now to make the switch, the mentalist reaches over with their right hand.
Getting ready for the move.
According to the Al Baker method, the mentalist presses their right thumb, which is wearing the plastic tip containing the dummy paper flat, down on top of the spectator's visible billet.
Flat down on top of it.
Right. They close their left fingers over the thumb and then pull the right thumb backward out of the fist. As they pull back, they drag the dummy paper out of the plastic tip, leaving the tip and the spectator's real billet safely hidden inside the closed left fist.
Okay, I read this description 3 times because I thought I was misunderstanding it. If you're sitting at your desk right now or if you have a piece of paper nearby, I really want you to try this.
Yeah, grab a piece of paper.
Tear off a piece of a post-it note. Put it in the palm of your left hand. Now reach over with your right hand and pick it up. Do it naturally. Don't think about it.
Pay close attention to the biomechanics of your fingers when you do it.
Where does your thumb go? Your thumb goes underneath the piece of paper. Your index finger, or your middle finger, goes on top to pinch it.
Because that's normal.
That is how the human hand is designed to grasp a small, flat object. Nobody in the entire history of human anatomy naturally picks up a tiny piece of paper by mashing their thumb flat on top of it and dragging it backward across their palm.
It's completely backward.
I tried doing the Al Baker move in the mirror. My right elbow flares out, my shoulder hunches up, my wrist locks into this weird, rigid angle. I look like a T-Rex trying to use a stapler. It feels ridiculous.
And yet, this method was taught as gospel for decades.
Why? Why would anyone do it that way?
Cassidy argues that the problem is entirely semantic. The prop was manufactured and sold under the name thumb tip.
Ah, so they just blindly followed the name.
Exactly. Because of that naming convention, generations of magicians blindly assumed, without ever questioning the biomechanics, that the device must be worn on the thumb.
That is wild.
They became psychologically trapped by the language of the manufacturer. They deferred to authority rather than trusting their own anatomical common sense.
It is so painfully obvious once he points it out. So Cassidy completely rewrites the biomechanical language of the move. His brilliantly simple solution, take the thumb tip and put it on your middle finger.
It changes everything. The shift in the physical mechanics is staggering.
How does his method work?
Let's detail Cassidy's new method. If you wear the plastic tip on your right middle finger, your hand naturally curls inward when relaxed, completely concealing the tip from the audience.
So it's already hidden.
Right. When the spectator holds out their billet, you reach for it. As your hand approaches, your palm naturally turns inward, facing the floor. The middle finger wearing the tip goes on top of the billet, and your thumb goes underneath.
Exactly how a normal human being picks up a piece of paper. Your thumb slides underneath, your middle finger rests on top, and as you close your grip, you simply drag the dummy billet out of the tip using your thumb.
It's seamless.
The switch is instantaneous. It requires no weird wrist angles, no flared elbows. It is biomechanically flawless because it mimics reality perfectly.
And he extends this exact same logic to another very common mentalism prop, the film canister.
Right, like the old black plastic tubes for 35mm film.
Performers often use small, narrow tubes or canisters to secretly load a prediction. A spectator holds a sealed canister, opens it, and finds a piece of paper inside that proves the mentalist knew what they were going to do.
But they actually sneak it in at the end.
Yes. To load that paper secretly at the last second, mentalists used to jam their thumb tip into the canister. Larry Becker, another legendary thinker in this space, and Cassidy both independently realize how awful this looked.
Because it's the wrong finger again.
Exactly. Huh. Reaching into a narrow cylindrical tube with your thumb is incredibly unnatural. When we want to pry something out of a narrow space, we instinctively use our index or middle fingers.
If I hand you a bottle of pills and ask you to fish one out, you don't jam your thumb in there. Your thumb is too thick and the angle of the wrist is completely wrong.
Which brings us to a foundational psychological concept that governs all deception. It's what we might call the phenomenon of subconscious alarm bells.
Subconscious alarm bells. I like that.
Think about this from an evolutionary perspective. The human brain is a hyper-tuned pattern recognition machine. We are highly evolved to recognize the natural, fluid movement of the human body.
We do it without even thinking.
We use it to assess threats, to read emotions, to anticipate actions. Now, an audience member sitting 50 feet away in a theater absolutely cannot see a thin, flesh-colored plastic tip on your finger. The visual information is there.
So they can't bust you on the prop itself.
Right. But if the performer's arm moves in a biomechanically unnatural way, if the shoulder tenses, if the wrist locks, if they mash a thumb on top of a paper to pick it up, the audience's subconscious registers a massive anomaly.
It's the uncanny valley of body language. They don't know what you did. If you pause the show and ask them, they couldn't tell you about a thumb tip or an Al Baker switch.
They have no idea.
But their brain is screaming, he just did something sneaky that wasn't a normal movement. They literally feel the deception, even if they can't see the mechanism.
Precisely. Flawless physical methods require the language of natural human movement. If your physical actions do not perfectly match the subconscious expectations of the audience, the illusion fractures immediately.
You have to align the secret method with the natural rhythm and anatomy of the human body.
Exactly. The invisible must look natural.
Okay. We've thoroughly explored how performers mask physical methods by making their movements look incredibly boring and natural, keeping the audience's subconscious quiet.
The defensive side of things.
Right. But I want to explore the offensive side of language. How do mentalists use spoken language, storytelling, and riddles to actively hijack the audience's conscious logical brain? How do you talk someone into a trap?
This represents the transition from physical misdirection to cognitive redirection.
Yeah.
It's no longer about hiding a prop. It's about creating a linguistic puzzle that traps the audience in a highly specific, restrictive way of thinking.
They box you in with words.
Yes. Cassidy provides a beautiful example of this with a storytelling routine he uses to demonstrate what he calls lateral thinking.
Ah, the farmer's daughter script. This is essentially a giant riddle told on a stage, but the setup is what makes it work.
The setup is crucial.
Before he even introduces the riddle, Cassidy goes out of his way to disarm the audience with self-deprecating humor. He starts talking about how he didn't go to some mystic monastery in Tibet to learn mind reading. He went to school on the small bus.
He's lowering their guard.
Exactly. And when he begins the actual story by saying, there's this farmer who had a daughter, he intentionally pauses, points to an older gentleman in the front row, and says, no, not that kind of story, sir.
It's a great icebreaker. The humor is a tactical deployment of language. It serves a very specific physiological purpose.
What's the purpose?
When people laugh, their defenses lower. The critical analytical part of their brain momentarily relaxes. By building rapport and making them chuckle, he is actively disguising the fact that he is laying the foundation for a cognitive trap.
So they don't even realize the game has started.
Right. He tells them they're going to need to pay very close attention to solve a puzzle, which engages their analytical minds, but the humor ensures they do it from a state of relaxed vulnerability rather than guarded skepticism.
Let me tell the actual story because it is a fantastic puzzle.
Go for it.
Cassidy sets the scene. A poor farmer owes a massive, insurmountable debt to a corrupt, cruel banker. The banker wants to foreclose on the farm and ruin the family, but he also really wants to marry the farmer's beautiful young daughter.
Classic melodrama.
Totally. The daughter naturally despises him. The banker proposes a game of chance to settle the matter. He says he will place two small pebbles into a level money bag, one white pebble and one black pebble.
Let's lay out the rules. The rules of the game are simple. The daughter must reach into the bag and blindly select one single pebble.
Okay, just one.
If she pulls out the white pebble, her father's debt is completely forgiven, and she does not have to marry the banker. But if she pulls out the black pebble, the debt is still forgiven, but she must marry the banker.
But there is a huge catch. The daughter is sharp-eyed. As they are standing on a path covered in gravel, she watches the banker bend down to pick up the pebbles.
And she sees what he does.
She clearly sees him cheat. He does not put one white and one black pebble in the bag. He secretly picks up two black pebbles and drops them both into the bag.
The game is entirely rigged. Let's look at the daughter's options here.
It's not looking good for her.
No, it's not. If she calls him out on his cheating and refuses to play, the banker will simply foreclose on the farm out of spite and ruin her father. If she reaches into the bag and pulls out both black pebbles to expose him, she embarrasses him, and again, he ruins her family.
Because he has all the power.
Exactly. And if she simply plays the game as instructed, she is mathematically guaranteed to draw a black pebble and be forced into a miserable marriage.
Cassidy actually pauses his stage show at this exact moment. He looks at the audience and says, "I think you will agree that this appears to be a completely impossible situation. Simple logical thinking tells us that she must select a black pebble and lose."
He's baiting them.
He literally challenges the audience. How can she possibly win this game without cheating herself and without exposing the banker's cheat?
And this is where the cognitive redirection takes hold.
Yeah.
The audience is now firmly trapped in what Cassidy identifies as logical thinking.
Which means what exactly?
Logical thinking focuses intensely, almost exclusively, on the direct action of the problem. What is withdrawn from the bag. Because the rules state she must draw a pebble, our brains immediately lock onto the pebble that will end up in her hand.
Right, because that's the action of the game.
And since we know both pebbles in the bag are black, any pebble withdrawn guarantees a loss. The logic is airtight, linear, and completely inescapable. We stare directly at the problem and see no way through.
I was completely stumped reading this. I was trying to figure out if she could swap a pebble from her pocket or throw the bag in a river.
But the daughter uses lateral thinking.
Yes. She realizes that the solution cannot possibly be found by looking at what is taken out of the bag. The parameters of that action are rigged. Instead, she shifts her focus entirely to what remains inside the bag.
The solution is a masterpiece of reframing.
It really is. The daughter reaches into the bag, grabs a pebble, and pulls it out. But before anyone can see what color it is, she deliberately fumbles and drops it onto the gravel path.
Where it's lost among the other pebbles.
Exactly. It is instantly lost among thousands of other identical black and white pebbles. She acts terribly clumsy. She apologizes profusely to the banker. "Oh, how clumsy of me," she says.
And then she drops the hammer.
But no matter. We can simply look at the pebble that is left in the bag. Whichever color is left in the bag, I must have drawn the opposite color.
It is brilliant.
Because the banker secretly put two black pebbles in the bag, the one remaining in the bag is obviously black. Therefore, by the established rules of the game, she must have drawn the white one.
The banker is completely trapped. The only way he could prove she drew a black pebble is by opening the bag, showing the second black pebble, and admitting in front of everyone that he cheated.
Which his ego will never allow him to do. She turns a 100% mathematical certainty of losing into a 100% guarantee of winning simply by shifting the focus from the direct action to the surrounding context.
This is a profound lesson in cognitive framing, and it is the exact blueprint of how mentalism works.
How does it translate to a magic trick, though?
By dropping the drawn pebble, the daughter forces the banker and the audience to look away from the rigged action and look at the remaining black pebble. A mentalist uses language to define the parameters of a trick, trapping your logical brain in a very specific loop.
So they give you the rules?
Right. They give you rigged rules. And while you are trapped in that loop, they operate laterally, completely outside those stated parameters. They tell you to watch their right hand, establishing the logic that the trick happens in the right hand, while the left hand is casually going into a pocket.
Thinking about how this applies to daily life is kind of staggering, honestly. How often do we get utterly stuck in logical problem solving?
Oh, all the time.
You're staring at a bottleneck at work or a recurring argument in a relationship, and you are laser focused on the drawn pebble. You are staring directly at the immediate obstacle, analyzing it, fighting it, and it seems impossible to overcome because the parameters are rigid.
But often, a slight shift in language, a shift in perspective, looking at what remains in the bag, looking at the environment surrounding the problem instead of the focal point, provides an elegant solution.
We get tunnel vision based purely on how a situation is initially presented to us.
And Cassidy is operating on multiple levels here. He uses this exact story not just as a fun brain teaser, but to actively frame his own abilities for the rest of the show.
Right.
This brings us full circle to the ethics of language we discussed earlier. After blowing the audience's mind with this lateral thinking puzzle, he explicitly denies being psychic. He looked at them and says, "I do not have supernatural powers. I don't speak to the dead. What I have is intuition."
The way he frames intuition is so clever. He tells the audience a joke about seeing an advertisement for a new computer program that boasts an intuitive interface.
It's a great analogy.
He says, "Computers are just silicon, logic gates, and math. How can a machine be intuitive? It doesn't have feelings." But, he explains, an intuitive interface simply means the program makes sense based on all the massive amounts of data it has processed.
It works exactly how you expect it to work, because it recognizes patterns.
Right. He then compares his own mind to that computer interface. He tells the audience that what we call intuition is not magic. It is simply the act of paying intense, focused attention to your subconscious mind.
He posits that the subconscious is a massive, incredibly fast database that records every life experience, every micro expression you've ever seen, every behavioral pattern you've ever observed.
So he's claiming he just has a really good connection to that database.
Exactly. He claims that his mind reading is just his conscious brain learning how to listen to the hyper-fast data processing of his subconscious. He reads patterns, not auras.
I love that framing. From a theatrical standpoint, it is incredibly powerful. It makes the impossible seem entirely logical and crucially attainable.
It's very grounded.
He isn't alienating the audience by claiming to be some infallible demigod with powers they could never understand. He is pulling them into the illusion. He makes them feel like, hey, if I just put away my phone and paid really close attention to the people around me, maybe I could develop this too.
It builds a profound, grounded connection with the crowd.
While still leaving them completely defenseless and astonished when he performs the next impossible trick.
Exactly. He is actively using lateral thinking on the audience in real time. He drops the psychic pebble, forcing them to look at the highly observant intuition pebble that remains in the bag.
And they totally buy it.
Because it sounds scientific and logical, they accept it completely, never realizing that hyper-intuition is just a newly painted frame around a carefully constructed illusion.
Which brings us to the final and undoubtedly the most intense segment of this deep dive. We've explored how performers mask physical methods by mimicking natural movement. We've seen how they use storytelling and lateral thinking to hijack logic.
And now we get to the really heavy stuff.
Right. Now we have to look at the ultimate frightening convergence of manipulative language and physical methods. Stage hypnosis.
This is where the stakes escalate dramatically.
Because in a standard mentalism routine, the goal is to fool an audience's perception. But in stage hypnosis, the goal is to completely publicly command the physical behavior of a volunteer.
It is the ultimate exercise in controlling human action through applied language.
The text drops an absolute bombshell right at the beginning of this section. Cassidy states, point blank, zero ambiguity, that stage hypnosis has absolutely nothing to do with real clinical therapeutic hypnosis.
Nothing at all.
In fact, he argues that the medical community still argues over what clinical hypnosis actually is, and for a stage performer, it fundamentally doesn't matter.
He backs this up by quoting Kreskin, the famous mentalist we mentioned earlier. Kreskin took a highly controversial, very public stance on this.
What did he say?
He stated unequivocally that the hypnotic trance state, the idea of a zombie-like altered state of consciousness where you have no free will, simply does not exist. it's a myth.
Wait, really? He just flat out said it's fake.
Yes. Kreskin was so confident in this that he offered a massive cash reward to any doctor or scientist who could definitively prove the existence of a hypnotic trance. Kreskin argued that what audiences label as hypnosis is merely the raw, unchecked power of social suggestion.
It is wild to hear a legendary performer admit that the core premise of the act is a fiction.
It really pulls back the curtain.
So if the trance isn't real, if these people aren't actually asleep or chemically altered, what in the world is happening up there on stage when 20 adults are suddenly clucking like chickens or forgetting their own names?
The real method is chilling in its simplicity. It is not a state of trance, it is a state of compliance.
Compliance? They're just following orders.
The performer does not need to possess magical mind control powers. They simply need to systematically filter a crowd until they find subjects who are highly susceptible to social pressure and who are willing to do exactly what they are told when they are told to do it in front of a large group of people.
Cassidy provides some really dark historical context to show how this compliance used to be achieved and how it has evolved.
It used to be pretty brutal.
Yeah. He talks about the early 20th century, referencing acts like the Dr. Q show performed by William Larson Sr. Back then, audiences were rougher and the methods were essentially just physical bullying.
They weren't using subtle psychology back then?
Not at all. The hypnotist would bring volunteers up and use brutal physical coercion. They would whisper violent threats or grip pressure points on the volunteer's neck or wrist that caused intense pain, essentially forcing the person to act like an instant stooge.
They weren't hypnotized. They were just intimidated into playing along so the guy would stop hurting them.
As society evolved and our understanding of psychology deepened, audiences would no longer accept a performer physically assaulting volunteers. So the coercion had to evolve.
It moved from physical intimidation to psychological manipulation.
And modern psychological coercion relies almost entirely on the language of the setup. It begins long before the performer ever asks for volunteers.
It begins with the pre-show language.
The pre-show trap. This is diabolical.
It really is a trap.
Here.
The hypnotist walks out, acts very academic, and tells the audience some scientific facts about hypnosis.
More pseudoscience.
Exactly. Specifically, they state, in a very authoritative tone, that contrary to popular belief, weak-minded people cannot be hypnotized. They announce that only highly intelligent, highly imaginative, and incredibly creative people possess the focus required to enter a trance.
It is the ultimate psychological snare.
It's brilliant, honestly.
It's the emperor's new clothes, weaponized for a theater. In that classic story, the weavers tell the emperor that the magical clothes are invisible to anyone who is stupid or incompetent at their job.
So everyone pretends to see them.
So everyone from the emperor to the townspeople pretends to see the clothes because no one wants to publicly out themselves as an idiot. The hypnotist is doing the exact same thing.
Yes. If you volunteer to go on stage and you don't comply, if you don't fall asleep when he snaps his fingers, or if you refuse to dance, you aren't proving the hypnotist is a fake.
You are publicly branding yourself in front of your friends and hundreds of strangers as unimaginative, unfocused, and unintelligent.
It places the entire burden of the trick's success squarely on the ego of the spectator. The performer builds an invisible linguistic cage around the stage.
And the volunteer walks right in.
The volunteer sits down, already feeling immense, crushing social pressure to play along, because resisting the suggestions means admitting a personal intellectual failure.
So the psychological trap is set. The volunteers want to be hypnotized so they look smart. But they still need a push.
They need something real.
Right. They need something physical to convince them that it's actually happening so they don't just feel like they're acting. Cassidy breaks down his specific induction script the moment he puts them under, and it is a masterpiece of manipulative language and biology.
Let's look at the induction. The volunteers are sitting in chairs on stage. The performer speaks in a slow, rhythmic tone, telling them to take deep breaths and relax.
Standard hypnosis stuff.
But notice the constant repetitive use of the word imagine. The script says, close your eyes and use your strong sense of imagination to pretend that my voice is your voice.
He is subtly tightening the trap. Use your imagination. Remember the pre-show speech? Only imaginative people can do this.
If you can't imagine his voice in your head, you're failing the intelligence test.
Then comes the physical mechanism hidden inside the language. The hypnotist walks up to a specific volunteer, touches them lightly on the forehead, and gives a very bizarre, specific instruction.
And this is the physical lock.
He says, pretend there is a spot on your forehead exactly where I touched you. I want you to keep your eyelids shut tight, but I want you to look upward at that spot from the inside of your head.
He tells them to keep their eyes locked on that imaginary upward spot and to imagine their eyelids are becoming heavy, glued together, locked tight.
He says, your eyes are locked. You cannot open them.
And here is the biological reality that makes the entire illusion crash down on the volunteer. If your eyeballs are physically rolled upward, looking toward your forehead, it is biomechanically impossible to open your eyelid.
Wait, is that actually true? Let's delve into the anatomy of that for a second.
It is entirely true. The muscle responsible for lifting your upper eyelid is called the levator palpebrae superioris.
Okay.
When you rotate your eye globe upward to its extreme limit, the mechanics of the eye socket change, the tissue stretches, and that levator muscle is placed at a severe mechanical disadvantage.
So it's a physical limitation.
It simply cannot generate the leverage required to pull the eyelid open against the tension. It is a physiological block.
I am literally trying it right now as we speak. If I close my eyes and roll my eyes as far up into my head as I can and try to open my lids, I can't.
You can't do it.
They flutter, they spasm, but I literally cannot open my eyes unless I let my eyeballs roll back down first. That is terrifyingly effective.
Now, synthesize that physical reality with the psychological state of the volunteer. They are sitting on a stage under hot lights. They've been primed with the language of imagination and intelligence.
They have been told they are entering a profound hypnotic state.
The hypnotist tells them they cannot open their eyes. They try to open their eyes and their body disobeys them. They physically cannot do it.
They don't realize it's just a quirk of cranial biology.
Yeah.
Their brain panics and says, the hypnotist told me I couldn't open my eyes and now my muscles aren't working. He has control of my body.
They interpret a simple anatomical limitation as proof of a successful, overwhelming hypnotic trance.
The psychological trap of the ego and the physical method of the eye lock snap together perfectly.
The friction disappears and they surrender completely to compliance. They are ready to cluck like chickens because they truly believe the performer is at the wheel.
But what happens if the lock fails? What if a subject isn't paying attention, doesn't roll their eyes up, and simply pops their eyes open, staring right at the hypnotist?
Cassidy has a script for that too, and it is absolutely ruthless. He doesn't panic.
What does he do?
He just looks at the non-compliant subject and dismisses them back to their seat, saying, that's all right, you can head back to the audience.
Yeah.
I guess you just aren't able to give enough concentration tonight. It does suggest you may be easily distracted.
Wow. It is a public execution of a non-compliant subject. He banishes them with the label of being unfocused or easily distracted, the exact opposite of the intelligent, creative person he praised earlier.
But he doesn't do this just to punish them. He does it for the benefit of the remaining subjects on stage. He is showing them exactly what happens to their ego and social standing if they decide to resist. The remaining subjects, terrified of being humiliated and labeled as distracted, grip the illusion even tighter. They will fight to remain compliant.
Oh. We have covered a massive amount of ground today. We started with haunted houses and ended with the physiological hijacking of the human body. Let's bring all these threads together.
It all comes down to the same core principle.
What we've learned from dissecting Bob Cassidy's work is that the art of deception, whether on a stage or in life, is fundamentally a two-handed game.
The right hand executes the physical method. It is the mechanics. It silently loads the ring onto the stick under the cover of a gesture. It shifts the plastic thumb tip to the middle finger to rewrite biomechanics. It forces the eye muscles into a biological lock.
But the left hand weaves the language. It provides the framing of scientific intuition instead of magic. It provides the misdirection of a joke about a farmer's daughter. It builds the psychological trap of ego and intelligence.
Without the language, the physical method is just a clumsy, suspicious puzzle. Without the method, the language is just an empty, unprovable promise.
But when they synchronize flawlessly, they create reality.
And this is why analyzing this text matters far beyond the confines of a theater. The tools we've deconstructed today aren't just for magicians.
No, they are everywhere.
The language of forced compliance, the reframing of intuition, the subconscious alarm bells of body language, the lateral thinking to shift focus from the problem to a rigged solution. These exact dynamics are playing out in corporate boardrooms, in high-stakes contract negotiations, in billion-dollar advertising campaigns, and in your daily conversations.
Politicians use lateral thinking to shift your focus from the broken system to their chosen scapegoat.
Salesmen use the language of ego to force your compliance, making you feel like only a smart person would buy their product.
It is a profound realization, and that leads us to a final lingering thought for you to ponder on your own time.
Something to take away.
We spent an hour talking about how performers use lateral thinking to manipulate our attention, and how they use carefully constructed language to force our compliance. But knowing what you know now about how easily the human mind accepts a rigged game if it is framed correctly, well, what core beliefs do you hold right now simply because someone presented them to you with the perfect, invisible thumb tip of natural-sounding language? Have you ever watched someone speak on television, felt that tiny thrill of absolute certainty, and completely missed the method hiding behind the words? Keep your eyes open, watch where the hands go, and question the language around you.